if there's nothing we've picked up in the last year, it has to be how much companies have been humanized.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. The rules of business are changing dramatically. I think we can all agree. In her new book, The 6 New Rules of Business, Creating Real Value in a Changing World, the Aspen Institute's Judy Samuelson describes the profound shifts in attitudes and mindsets that are redefining our notions of what constitutes business success. And given how rapidly our world is shifting at the moment, I thought she'd be the perfect person to have on. Judy, welcome to Future Proof.
Glad to be here, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to be chatting. I wanted to ask you, in your own words, Judy, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Judy Samuelson. I am the executive director of the Aspen Institute's Business and Society Program, which was about leaders, and it's about problem-solving, dialogue, and pursuit of better understanding the role of corporations and changes that need to make to be able to capture the extraordinary capacity of business to solve some of our complex problems.
Yeah, and obviously it's such a shifting landscape these days, not just in terms of how businesses operate, but how we think about business success. So what's going to constitute business success in the coming years from your perspective?
I think it's going to be a fundamental kind of reordering of where business pays, you know, kind of putting the health of the commons at the center of the business enterprise. Years now, we've been operating under this mantra of shareholder primacy, and the shareholder and the share price and profit maximization has been the organizing principle for business decision making. And I think we're in a time of extraordinary change. The years ahead, however, are going to be, in order to make this an authentic change, it's going to require the kind of like undoing some of the scaffolding that keeps shareholder primacy in place in order to allow the real change to take place. The consumers and citizens are pretty quick to nose out when reality doesn't meet intentions. And now the purpose of the corporation is revealed. We're going to see a real reordering of what's important and whether or not we're sticking to our intentions in the decisions we make inside companies.
I think that's true. And as an aside, I've told people for years, just imagine for publicly traded companies, if they could report every 6 months instead of every quarter, would that be more of a good thing or a bad thing? And I've always argued that would be a little bit less short-term thinking. And of course, 6 months, you're still thinking about how are you going to present those results, but maybe we would be in a slightly better place.
Or let's get rid of those kind of standard timeframes altogether and report when it makes sense. So there's a lot of industries that are reporting all the time on certain aspects of what the investor wants to know about. Same month or same year sales and same day sales and all those kinds of things you do in the retail industry. So what really makes sense for an industry? Maybe we could lighten up on that. It has to be quarter to quarter anyway.
So you talk a lot about things like reputation and trust that'll drive business value and are hard to quantify, but surely we need to quantify things like that, right? Like how are we going to measure them and how are organizations going to make sure that they're heading in the right direction if they can't measure these things? So just playing devil's advocate a bit.
It's good to remember that it's the things that are hard to measure, which economists call intangibles, or maybe we all call intangibles. Intangible values, those are the things that they're almost impossible to measure. They're things like trust, reputation, perceptions that people have. Intellectual property is an intangible. Certainly customer loyalty and employee loyalty and their attitudes and how they show up for work. Those are all things that are qualities of how we work that are absolutely fully instrumental, and they are the only thing that can be really explaining the difference between kind of the tangible assets of the firm and sometimes crazy notions of value that show up on the stock market. So it's the intangibles. Yes, do we need to measure them? I like to quote a guy named Jerry Muller, who wrote a book called The Tyranny of Metrics. And the quote is, "Metrics lose their meaning when used to reward or punish performance rather than to diagnose and analyze." I am vastly more interested in metrics that help us figure out what's wrong, where we need a course correction, how we move forward, and are not designed to simply allow people to make simple comparisons between firms. So if we're talking about we need to be able to measure them, yes, I'll give an example of employee engagement scores. Companies do that because they really want to understand what their employees are thinking. Are they fully present? Do they understand what their jobs are? What are their attitudes about? Are they proud to work for the company or not? Those things help the company figure out what kind of course correction is required in order to build a more productive working relationship with its own allies, its employees. So that would be an example of the kind of measurement that I think makes sense, as opposed to thinking that we can somehow put a dollar value on trust.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I was actually going to say, I cannot say it as eloquently as that quote that you had, but I think what's interesting is that we can measure so much these days. And some of the people I've spoken to might be undervaluing some of the things that are harder to measure and just focusing on the low-hanging fruit of the things that are easy to measure. And there are obviously negative consequences to only focusing on the things that are easy to measure.
Yeah. And then it raises a question, who are we measuring it for? There's a lot of attention that's paid to the stock market and stock valuations. That is not a recipe for real value creation. There's a big disconnect between, we've seen it recently in this craziness on the run-up on GameStop, but that has nothing to do with the real values of the company. It has nothing to do with its real future. And so we need to ratchet back the degree to which we're coming up with metrics to somehow appease a third party who's interested in some kind of price on the stock, as opposed to really capturing the capacity of the firm and enabling business to move forward and deal with issues of extraordinary consequence.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about how there's a major problem that goes back a while with corporate greed and short-termism. And it seems like we've been stuck with those issues for some time now. But what are the solutions if we wanted to get rid of that, if we wanted to have companies thinking more about the long term on an ongoing basis?
Well, there's no getting rid of it. You know, it's always been the notion of how do we do better with it. Indra Nooyi, the former CEO of Pepsi, used to say that the long term is just a bunch of short terms. And there's some truth in that. It's not that executives can disconnect from the reality of current pressures and, you know, expectations. But you can operate in a context in which you have clarified why the business, what business it's in, what is it intending to do, what is its purpose, and set a long-term goal to realize that purpose, to make sure that it's an authentic direction that the company is taking. And that requires taking a long-term view. And it definitely requires stepping outside of the kind of short-term buzz of the market and being thoughtful about what's absolutely necessary to nail in order to succeed over the long haul. And that's going to be different for every single company. It's going to be different for different industries. So not all stakeholders are the same. It's one of the reasons I don't really like that term very much, is I don't think it actually helps managers think about what's most important. So I'd say that long-termism is about setting a direction, clarifying what you truly need to measure, where you really need to understand how you're making progress or not. And then it also says a lot about internal rewards and incentives. And so what are we paying people to do?
I actually want to get to stakeholders in a second, so let's come back to that. But I wanted to ask you, I think a lot of people have really thought a lot about American values and how those are different from some individual markets or, you know, global values in general. How are American values different from those of others in terms of business success, in terms of what is valued in the within the corporation?
I'd be curious what you think about this too, but I think that we love the private sector in the United States. We believe in it. We believe in private enterprise. It is a vastly different environment to operate in than, say, many countries in Europe that have a profoundly different relationship between government and the private sector than we do in the United States. So I think that's certainly one that occurs to me. We believe people admire business leaders who are authentic. We hold them in high esteem. That has never really changed. It doesn't mean we hold all parts of the business sector in high esteem or that it doesn't suffer from a lack of trust. Clearly, we have low trust in institutions of all kinds in this country. But I'd say we have a it goes right to our founding. We have been, our public goods have always been the product of a combination of certainly government infrastructure and investment, but also private investment in public goods. And so it's a complex dance in the U.S. It's not for the faint of heart, but I think it is a profoundly different environment to operate.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I think that as I was taking a look at the book, I couldn't help but think, depending on your vantage point globally, you're going to be interpreting the problems and also the business values that are going to succeed in any given market. They're going to be different from one to the other. And I thought the other thing that this was something I almost had to challenge a little bit as I was reading about it. In the book, you talk about the decline in importance of capital to success. But given how many powerful incumbents are out there, and also given how many startup founders I know listen to the show, how do you make that argument that capital is not as much of an impediment as it might have been historically?
We're awash in capital. Our interest rate right now is zero. Capital isn't it's not the chief constraint. It might have been, certainly was a century ago or 50 years ago. It was certainly more of one. When General Motors was at the top of the tables, it's all bricks and mortar and investment and tangible investment. And growth was, you couldn't grow without continuing to build, in essence. But when our largest companies today reside in the tech sector and are a function of some intellectual property and some ways of operating, but the real kind of bricks and mortar aspects of this are happening at a great remove from the company, capital is just not as scarce. It's not a scarce resource. The scarce resource is talent. The scarce resource is whether or not you have the capacity to build a robust culture. There are other things that are much more difficult to manage than capital access. I'm not saying it doesn't matter at all. And there's clearly an aftermarket that we hear a lot from. But it's not a scarce resource. And we have lots of examples. I write about a couple of them in the book, Spotify and Snapchat, that when they went public, they really went public in name only. And it was only to allow their early investors an exit or to have a listing. But it was not, they did not raise, they didn't do a traditional IPO where they went in and raised capital and then allocated power and votes to those who came in as a public company. So that's changed a lot.
To build on that, what might be powerful to a company like Facebook is the fact that there are network effects to their product and that they have a lead on you. It's not the fact that they might have more money in the bank than you, because if you found a better way to challenge them, then you might have a chance of success in the market.
Good luck. They got a lot of capital.
Right. But no, but it's a good distinction to make that historically,
no,
it's not. I thought another thing that was interesting is you talk a lot about corporate responsibility. And how will the definition of corporate responsibility evolve in the years to come?
It's already evolved a lot in the sense that responsibility used to be defined almost inside the gates. It's what mattered inside the company? What did our fence line neighbors or the host community, what did they care about? And were we paying attention to some of those connections? So certainly maintaining a decent license to operate vis-a-vis the government, that sort of thing has always mattered. But today, the definition of the company's responsibility is could be managed by an NGO that exists at great remove from the company, has a point of view or a scarce resource that it's working to protect, or a set of protocols and behaviors that it needs to change in the domain of, say, human rights or labor standards. And it can essentially hijack your firm and drive their point home by attaching things that may be ways, it could even be things that are outside your control, but they rebound to the company in terms of its reputation. Another example would be the companies are responsible today for how the consumer uses the product. You know, there's case law that has settled on that kind of thing. That was never the domain of responsibility of the company before. So what's different is that it's very fluid. You have extended supply chains with extraordinary complexity on everything from water scarcity and soil and to labor and human standards and how they exist and the complex interactions that requires through lots of different parties that sometimes have to collaborate together. So it's a very different domain to be operating in.
Yeah, I think Another area where certainly we're in uncharted territory is how employees are becoming more than stakeholders. That's the argument that you make, which I think makes a lot of sense. How can businesses get their heads around that fact and try to, you know, what's going to separate the winners and losers when it comes to maximizing the impact that an employee can have to helping drive that company forward?
I think employees really are the new accountability mechanism for companies to a much greater degree, much profoundly than customers or consumers or investors, certainly. Investors come in all shapes and sizes. They really want different things. They have different time horizons. They have different levels of influence and power, clearly. Customers are bound to price and convenience, largely. Employees are your allies. They really want the same things you want. They want the company to be successful. They want it to last a long time because that's in lies their own financial security and job security. But they also have the ability to mirror both the outside and the inside. Employees, younger employees, but I think it's always been true. It's just that boomers like me didn't tend to speak about these things as much in the workforce. But it's not that people haven't always wanted to be able to resolve who they are at home and who they are at work or what they care about when they're on Sundays compared to what they think about on Monday. The employees are, I don't think they've ever just been stakeholders. Stakeholders sounds like something that needs to be managed down the hall or outside. They, in fact, if there's nothing we've picked up in the last year during kind of the time of COVID, it has to be that how much companies have been humanized in essence for us. And how much our fate relies on a spirit of enterprise that we've seen evidenced in the fast pace of advance on developing vaccines. This is all about employees. This is about employees on the healthcare side and the risks and precautions that exist throughout our system in terms of public health in this moment. Frontline workers, I could go on and on about it. But if executives have not been awakened to that reality, I'm not sure what to say. It's very present in this moment.
Oh, and another thing is, yeah, I think about the creativity and innovation in bringing vaccines to market quickly, which then also makes me think about that's certainly something that you make the argument organizations can do a better job at fostering that type of creativity and innovation internally. See how I tie that all together?
You did nicely. Thanks.
If one was going to start an organization from scratch, let's say, how would you set it up for success when it comes to creativity and innovation in 2021?
I am drawn to questions of culture. I do believe that we have wonderful examples of companies. I write about Herman Miller. I write about Southwest. Companies that have always put employees at the center. Herman Miller with its attention to design and designers from the founding. Southwest, Herb Keller's commitment to, you know, he knew that treating employees well or putting them at the heart of the enterprise was instrumental in growing a great airline. I think that those questions naturally enable innovation and creativity. Certainly was the case with Herman Miller, where employees became the front line in thinking about sustainability in that industry and making your furniture and use of design, maybe way before their competitors. Southwest, an incredibly creative place to work. So I think that's where I'd have to go with this question of enabling innovation.
Yeah, because I think it's really interesting. There's obviously a perfect way to do it if you were going to start from scratch. But then also, like you're talking about a lot of established companies who might have had a culture of it that dates back decades, or they found a way to, from a change management perspective, inject that new culture and embrace that. And it is interesting how there are a lot of companies out there who might not be doing this, maybe fall by the wayside and have a bit of a wake-up call and realize that they have to find a better way to inject that creativity and foster change internally.
Absolutely. I think that's true. I love the craft beer industry. I love how they compete fiercely, but they're also drawn to collaborate, that they're building on one another. And it's almost like the entire industry has a spirit of collaboration in this, in pursuit of innovation and in improving your own product in the process, learning from one another. I actually think that's going to be, as we look back on this time of developing these vaccines, the movie version of this, I think, is going to have companies collaborating across these lines, cracking the code on this disease in real time, enabling different products to emerge in different firms, but that there would have been a culture of engagement that is somewhat unique in industry.
I was working at a company once where they wanted to get some inspiration from outside, and I presented a list of people who could speak to the organization, and they said, that's too close to what we're doing. And I'm thinking, but if they're doing a good job and they're willing to speak to you, who's to say you can't learn from them? And maybe there's a rising tide that lifts all ships.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right.
I know you have to go about your busy book tour, but this has been really great. I know people will get a lot out of this conversation and the book in general. So we'll put a link to the show notes, and congrats on this launching big and everything else you're working on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Judy for making the time. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.